This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to the Dirsch Show, counting down until my vacation. I'm on today, I'm on tomorrow. If the Supreme Court were to come down with its decision on race-based affirmative action, say on Thursday or Friday, I'd probably want to come on and do a special show for that. But absent any major developments, be gone for about 3.5 weeks. And I'll miss you, but I'll see you shortly. So today we're going to talk about CNN's playing of the audio of Donald Trump talking to a writer and a publisher and apparently showing them some papers, which the government claims were classified and contained top secret information about America's planning in the event that it decided to attack Iran, if Iran were getting close enough to building an atomic arsenal. So I heard the tape, and I had already read the transcript, so there was nothing particularly new in the tape, except when you hear the voice of the former president saying what he said, you realize how powerful a piece of evidence that can be in front of the jury. Remember, Trump's probably not going to testify. So the only time that the jury will hear his voice is when recorded conversations of his are played. This won't be the only one. There'll be others as well. The prosecution will probably put on his interview with Fox News, in which he says, well, they weren't classified material. They're just newspapers and magazines, to try to prove that he wasn't telling the truth. As far as I know, the government doesn't have the piece of paper. Maybe they do, but we don't know that they have the piece of paper to determine whether it actually contained classified material or not. The CNN disclosure raises a number of issues. Let me start with the first one. How the heck did CNN get this audio recording? There are only three possible sources. Number one would be a prosecutorial leak, a leak by somebody who was in the prosecutorial team. It had to be somebody who actually had literal access to the tape, because I'm sure that was held under pretty close circumstances on a need-to-know basis. If that happened, you know, it's a major, major violation of law, rules, and ethics, and it would be good to find that out, and it would obviously result in a motion to suppress the tape and seek other kinds of relief. No indication that the motion would necessarily be granted, but it would create real problems for the government. Another possibility is that somebody on Trump's defense team leaked it to CNN without Trump's permission, because obviously Trump didn't want this leaked and he objected to it. Third would be maybe the person who made the recording, who is a staff member, leaked it, or maybe a copy of the recording was given to the writer of the book about Meadows and his role as chief of staff. All of those possibilities are there, and we're not going to learn who the source was from CNN. They're going to withhold the information about the source, and they're not going to be compelled to reveal it, most likely. We don't know for sure, but I think it's important for investigative journalists to start poking around and find out where they got this tape. They certainly didn't get it in the normal course of events, and the fact that CNN got it rather than Fox getting it indicates to me that the source was somebody who was anti-Trump, somebody from the left, or somebody who wanted to see Trump embarrassed. Certainly it didn't, I don't believe, come from the Trump people. I don't see any possible benefit that he gets out of it, even though he's claimed it's exculpatory. He's going to have to explain that a little better to me as to how it's going to be exculpatory. I could see, on the face of it, it's incriminating. On the face of it, it has the former president saying, I could have declassified this material when I was president. I didn't declassify it. It's secret, but here I'm showing it to you. So that's on its face inculpatory, not exculpatory. Maybe Trump knows something we don't know, but I don't know what that would be. One possibility, and it's only a possibility, is that Trump can't be prosecuted for that piece of classified material for two reasons. Number one, we don't have it. So it's going to be hard to prove beyond a reasonable doubt it was actually classified. And related to that is this. It's not only the president who can declassify material. That's a myth that you read about. Only the president can declassify. The vice president can't. That's true. But declassification can occur without intervention by the president. For example, if the New York Times were to have published that battle plan, that automatically would declassify it. If it's in the public domain, it's declassified. So Trump's defense may very well be that whether the president knew it or not, it wasn't any longer top secret. It had been out there. It's been in the newspapers. And maybe that's what he was saying in a kind of clumsy way when he said, well, you know, those were newspapers and magazines. Maybe what he was saying is the content of what I showed them was already in newspapers and magazines, so it had already been effectively declassified. Now, let's assume that's true for a moment. I want to go to a Harvard Law School first-year class in criminal law? I taught that case over and over again for 50 years. Here's the issue. What if the following was true? What if Trump, in his mind, believed that the documents were classified and showed them to these people thinking they were classified? But what if he was wrong? What if they had become declassified by public disclosure? The question then arises, could he be charged with an attempted crime? That is, a crime that basically says, if the facts were as he believed them to be, he would have been guilty, but the facts weren't as he believed them to be, so he's only guilty of attempting to commit the crime. Well, I had the leading case. I litigated the leading case on this issue, the case that's in all the case books. My client was a small-time marijuana dealer in Brooklyn, and he had two accomplices, and one of the accomplices was saying to my client, you better, was actually saying to the third person in the room, you better pay me what I'm owed. And the guy says, I don't owe you anything. I'm not going to pay you anything. And the guy said, oh yeah, if you don't pay me, I'm going to shoot you. And my client looked like he's not going to shoot him for over a couple of $100. And sure enough, he did. The bad guy, the real bad guy, shot the person and shot him in the heart. And he fell back. And then he turned to my client and said, you're the only one who saw me shoot him. And under New York law, an accomplice testimony can't be used to convict without corroboration. There's no corroboration. So I want you to become an accomplice. I want you now to shoot him as well. My client did, took the gun, shot him in the head. By that time, he was clearly dead. The question is, was he also clearly dead at the time that he was shot through the heart? And at the trial, I was not the trial lawyer. The prosecution introduced evidence by a medical examiner saying he might have still been alive and his heart might still have been beating even though he was shot and would have died, but he might have still been alive until he was shot in the head. And so he was convicted, sentenced to life imprisonment. I was asked to do the appeal. The guy didn't have any money, but I did the appeal. And I raised the point. It hadn't been proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was alive. All the person medical examiner said is he might have been alive. That's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court agreed with me and said, no, he can't be convicted of murder. Famous sentence that's quoted all the time. Man dies but once. So then the question came up, could he be convicted of attempted murder if he actually believed that the guy might have been alive, even though by law You couldn't prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And after litigating the case up to the New York Court of Appeals and litigating it to the federal court, we won. And the courts essentially held that you couldn't convict somebody of attempted murder for killing a corpse, for trying to kill a corpse, for shooting a corpse. There had been a lot of cases like that in the law books and in fiction. Sherlock Holmes, there's one famous incident where Moriarty is trying to kill Holmes. Holmes knows that. So he gets Madame Tussaud to make a complete wax replica of him, puts him, the replica, in a rocking chair, and the replica is rocking back and forth. And Moriarty thinks it's Sherlock Holmes and blows his head off, blows the head off of the wax dummy. And the question is, could Moriarty be convicted of attempting to murder Holmes? So that's the issue that may, believe it or not, come up in this case, because it may be in the end that the government can't prove that the documents were actually classified documents. Can't prove that because A, they don't have the documents, and B, they may not be able to prove that the material in the documents hadn't already been disclosed in the public. And if that was the case, they will use the tape to prove that in his mind, Donald Trump believed the material was still classified. He said so. He said, I could have declassified it as president, but I didn't, and it's still secret. So it would be very, very interesting to see if it comes down to a law school class as to whether or not Donald Trump could be convicted of attempting to possess and show classified material. Look, we're a long way away from a trial. We're a long way away from a conviction, certainly. And we'll see. Donald Trump has not been making his situation any easier by giving a variety of explanations. And his lawyers, I'm sure, are twisting and turning and saying, please, please, you remember that fish that's mounted? The stuffed fish says, I'd still be swimming if I kept my mouth shut. Please listen to that and keep your mouth shut and don't start explaining. But what people forget about is that Donald Trump is being tried in two courts. And I don't mean New York State Court and federal court. I mean, he's being tried in the courts of law, both in New York and in Florida, federal court. But he's also being tried in the court of public opinion because he's running for president. We've never had that before. And when you're a defendant and a candidate for president, it's a little too much to ask that you keep your mouth shut and don't say anything to anybody about anything. So Donald Trump's going to talk. Whether he continues to talk about these things or not, I don't know. And we'll have to wait and see. And what evidence unfolds, we'll have to wait and see. So I would say that the recording that I listened to on CNN and that many of you probably have listened to is a very important piece of evidence, but it's probably not by itself conclusive, but it requires explanation. And, you know, the old saying, never explain. No, sometimes you have to explain. And if you are on tape showing documents, what appear to be documents, to somebody who's unauthorized to see classified material, and you're saying, I could have declassified it when I was president, but I didn't, it's still secret, but I'm showing it to you. And it clearly relates to what they were discussing, namely whether or not Trump was in favor of attacking Iran, and what Trump was doing was showing the writer, no, it was General Milley who wanted to attack Iran. Look, here's what he gave me. He gave me these battle plans. They come from the Defense Department. Certainly sounds like they may have been classified material. Now, what we don't know, too, is whether or not Donald Trump actually showed any of these documents to the writer and to the publisher, or whether he just waved it in front of them and said, see, this is confidential, this is classified, but I'm showing it to you. See what a big shot I am? I can show you classified material. Shh, don't tell anybody. It's off the record. He says that. He says it's off the record. He doesn't say don't tell anybody, but he says it's off the record. Don't publish it. And so there's a lot in this case. If, I think I've mentioned this before. If I was still teaching at Harvard Law School, as I taught for all these years, I think I'd I think I'd be teaching this case. It's a very important one. I'd probably be thrown out of the classroom if I made any suggestion that there's a possibility, maybe, that Trump is not guilty. At Harvard, he's guilty. And on Martha's Vineyard, he's guilty. But the question is, will he be found guilty in the court of law? Will he be found guilty in the court of public opinion? What impact will this have on his campaign? We already know that it's raised his poll numbers among Republicans, and that he will almost assuredly get the Republican nomination if he seeks it, which he is doing. We don't know what impact this will have on the general election. I can't see how it would help him in the general election, because the general election will be determined not by stalwart Republicans, we know who they're going to vote for, or stalwart Democrats, we know who they're going to vote for, but by independents. And the number of independents who might be influenced by a prosecution, a conviction, or by what they believe is evidence of criminal conduct, nobody knows that. Nobody will ever know it. So it's going to always be a little bit up in the air. But we live in interesting times. And I have to tell you, as a lawyer, we live in particularly interesting times, because all these issues that I've been teaching about for years have now come into fruition. For example, when I taught about the Constitution and when I argued the case in the Senate on behalf of President Trump's first impeachment, I spent a lot of time on Article 2 of the Constitution giving authority over elections to state legislatures. And today the Supreme Court decided a case saying, yeah, they have authority. State legislatures do have authority. It's in the Constitution. But that authority can be limited by state courts, giving power that was not in the Constitution to the judiciary. It was a 6-3 decision, and pragmatically probably the right decision, because it prevents state legislatures controlled by one party from really turning the election over to that party by gerrymandering or by creating restrictions on voting, et cetera. What the Supreme Court merely said was that the usual rules that operate within a state, legislature gets to do this, governor has a veto power, the courts have the power to interpret, that applies to Article 2 of the Constitution. Very pragmatic result, the typical decision by the Chief Justice John Roberts, who's a pragmatist and who cares deeply about the institution of the Supreme Court. He got two conservatives to go along with him. You know, the court is now divided into three groups. Liberals who will always, almost always, vote the liberal way. Conservatives who will almost always vote the conservative way, with two of them always voting the conservative way, pretty much. And then three, sometimes two, sometimes four, that will sometimes go with the other side. And Roberts is primary among them. He is the third group. He's always in that, almost always in that group. Sometimes he has Kavanaugh with him, as he did this time. Sometimes he has Barrett with him, as he did this time. Sometimes, but not this time, he has Gorsuch with him. Generally not Alito, and almost never Thomas. So that's the lineup of the Supreme Court. And we'll see tomorrow how they line up. If it's tomorrow, it'll either be tomorrow, Thursday, or Friday, almost certainly, that the Supreme Court will tell Harvard and North Carolina and other schools can't explicitly use race in deciding who to admit. Then we'll see how the schools respond to it, whether they actually obey the Supreme Court or find ways of circumventing what they regard as an ill-advised opinion. So stay tuned. Let's turn to some questions, good ones today. Well, Professor, do you agree with the SCOTUS decision that state courts have the right to intervene in elections and that the control of elections is not plenary to state legislatures? It seems this has transferred a lot of power to the judiciary. I agree with that. I agree with both. Generally, I agree with the decision, but I also think that it violates the explicit terms of the Constitution. The Constitution was probably wrong in allocating to the state legislature, as distinguished from allocating to the state the power to determine elections. I think they meant to allocate it to the state, and they designated the legislature rather than the process, because the process involves legislation, gubernatorial veto, judicial review. So it's complicated. Probably the Supreme Court got it right from a pragmatic point of view, but not a strict constitutional point of view. I can tell you how my friend Nino Scalia would have voted without a doubt with the dissenting judges. He would have said, hey, Constitution is what the words say and what they meant in 1790, whatever. And I'm not here to change the law. I'm not here to decide what's the best policy. I'm not here to be pragmatic. I'm here simply to apply what the framers said and what they meant when they wrote those words in the Constitution. That's clear. Now, you can agree or disagree with that. Okay. Professor, if the House had charged President Trump with extortion instead of abuse of power, would he have been properly impeached? Well, if there was evidence of extortion, that is a constitutionally valid ground. The Constitution says treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Other high crimes and misdemeanors. I interpreted that correctly as meaning crimes that involve governance and that are akin to bribery and treason. And I think extortion in a context of the kind that was alleged both against President Trump and against President Biden would constitute impeachable offenses if the evidence supported it. Okay. This is one relating to the sign that I showed you, which I still have hanging up. Impeach Dershowitz. It's the right thing. Get him off the island. So somebody writes, impeach you? Reminds me of the great Yankee player, Mr. October, Reggie Jackson, when asked if he opposed, if opposing fans constantly booing him bothered him. He said, no, people don't boo just anybody. I guess, and people don't put signs up about just anybody. My Reggie Jackson story. So a couple of years ago, I went to a Yankee game at the invitation of the owners and managers of the Yankees. And so they sat me in the owner's box. And who was there? Reggie Jackson. I've always loved Reggie Jackson. You know, even though I was a Red Sox fan and I rooted against the Yankees, I always admired great players. And, you know, what Reggie Jackson did at the end of the season as compared to what other players, Mr. April and Mr. May have done was always very admirable. Big Poppy was also another Mr. October. And I said to him, Mr. October, and believe it or not, this is what he said to me, my son's a witness. He said, Mr. October, you're Mr. October. I said, why am I Mr. October? He said, well, you're the great authority on the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court meets starting in October, so you're Mr. October. That was such a great compliment coming from Mr. October, being called Mr. October. Well, thank you, Reggie Jackson. He was amazing. I loved talking to him. He had a really good sense of humor, a lot shorter than I thought he was. I mean, when I didn't recognize him immediately, he was wearing glasses and, you know, looked a little older. I don't look any older, of course, but he looked a little older. But I really, really got a kick out of talking to him. I love talking to, you know, basketball old timers. I spoke to Steve Garvey the other day on the phone, and we were reminiscing about Sandy Koufax, who I grew up with on the same block. I didn't grow up with him, but I grew up on the same block and would see him from time to time and interact with him from time to time. And for my 50th birthday, my wife arranged for him to come and have dinner with me. So those are great times going back to the days of Ebbets Field and Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium. Yankee Stadium still exists. Of course, it's a different building, but I still love going there because I remember seeing Joe DiMaggio play there and seeing Mickey Mantle play there and watching some of the great games. I never saw a World Series game until I grew up and became able to finally buy tickets to a World Series game. Never saw a World Series game in person, but I saw many other games. And I went to Yankees games, got on a train, and of course, Brooklyn Dodger games. It was four blocks away from my high school, so I went to hundreds of those games. Okay, here's one that I just fundamentally disagree with. Turnabout is fair play. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Tit for tat is part of politics. The Republicans are compelled by natural law to impeach Nixon, to impeach Biden. No, I don't agree with that. I, in fact, my former research assistant, one of the best ones I ever had, who I regard as a mentee, and he worked for the Trump legal counsel's office. He supports the impeachment of Biden, not necessarily on independent grounds, but on the ground, hey, the Republicans should do what the Democrats did. I just don't agree with that. I think two wrongs do not make a right. Two wrongs make a fight. And I'd rather see one party, whichever one, say, no, we're not going to do this. We're not violating the Constitution just because the other side did. I know that's wishful thinking. Mr. Dershowitz, does the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy apply to impeachment? It's good when you get a question sometimes that there is actually a right answer to. Let's say a private citizen is convicted of a federal crime. Sometime later, he wins election to federal office. Could he be impeached for the crime that he was convicted of while he was a private citizen? And he could be convicted. And he could be impeached. The double jeopardy clause explicitly does not apply to impeachment. Indeed, you can be impeached and then prosecuted for exactly the same crime after you're impeached and after you leave office. So a simple answer to a very good and interesting question. You can agree with him or not, but for any library anywhere to cancel him, referring to me, much less his local library, is just beyond belief. It's so reminiscent of the Cultural Revolution in China. Well, that's what we have here in Martha's Vineyard. There is a cultural revolution, a Chinese cultural revolution taking place in Martha's Vineyard. The zealots on the hard left are using precisely the tactics. Now, they can't send me to a pig farm to work as they did with the Cultural Revolution. I was actually in China when the Cultural Revolution ended, and I met with a lot of the lawyers who had been sent to pig farms and sent them books, and I sent them other things that they needed to renew and restart their career. But what's going on in Martha's Vineyard is the aspects of the Cultural Revolution, aspects of Stalin's political correctness. We don't like who you represent. We're going to cancel you. Of course, I couldn't care less, because these are mostly really, really stupid, intolerant people who I am shocked that I ever befriended. I fault myself for having allowed myself to befriend some of these people. I did it only to be polite. I never liked them, but I was their neighbor, so I had to be polite. Thank God I don't have to be polite to them anymore. One of them came over to me. I was sitting and having dinner with somebody, one of the few people who was dinner with me on the vineyard, and came over to me and looked at me, and I just turned away, and I had no interest in talking to him, and now I have an excuse for not talking to him. So thank you for freeing me of the absurdities of so many people in Chilmark on Martha's Vineyard. It is incorrect to suggest that Jim Crow laws permitted lynching. Although enforcement may have been uneven, murder was always illegal. I just disagree. Murder was not only legal, it was encouraged. Take the case of Leo Frank. Leo Frank was lynched, and he was lynched by a crowd that included local minister, local sheriff, local judges. When you have a crowd that is lynching, that includes judges and politicians and lawyers and you name it, that makes murder of some people legal. Murdering a white person was still illegal. In this case, it was a white person, but he was Jewish, and Jews weren't regarded as white by the Ku Klux Klan and by the others who led the lynching party against the innocent Leo Frank. But no, I think under Jim Crow, murder was legal, accepted, and justified by the state. You might say murder was illegal in Nazi Germany, too. Yeah, there were still statutes on the books, but 6 million people, including 1 million children, were taken into gas chambers and murdered with the authority of the state. So murder was legal during Jim Crow. Murder was legal during the Holocaust. And no matter how you try to twist it, you can't really, really eliminate that conclusion. Mr. Dershowitz, if someone knowingly breaks what is widely considered an unjust law, how would you defend that person? Well, I've done it. I've done it over and over again. I defended people on the basis of the injustice of laws that prohibit free speech, dissent, that prohibit conscious objection to the military. Every case requires a different kind of defense. Sometimes you try to come up with a defense that partakes of unconstitutionality so you can raise it. Sometimes you just have to arrange it so that the jury could engage in jury nullification. You generally can't argue jury nullification, but the jury can understand your arguments that way. Great questions today. We'll have more tomorrow. See you tomorrow and get used to spending Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays without me for a few days. See you tomorrow.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.